Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a quick shout-out before I begin to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. I'd also like to utilize this opportunity to give a huge shout-out and thank you to the awesome people who have supported me over at patreon.com/mtginquarantine. So, thank you to the following: Mr. Big Bence, Anomaly, Draco Lucian, Neo Royal, Nick S., Infamous Fridge, and Frugal Brutal for supporting the show. If you'd like to help support the show, help me make more awesome content, head on over to patreon.com/mtginquarantine for more information. Today's episode of the podcast is going to be a really exciting look at trying to see how having a range of decks at different power levels and optimization levels can be really important for your next game night. In order to talk about this episode, I'd like to introduce a new friend to the show. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce John from the Gemstone Mine podcast. Welcome, welcome.
Hey, thanks for the welcome, MJ.
No problem. So before we begin, John, where can people find the Gemstone Mine podcast if they're interested in learning more about what you do?
All right. So you can find us on YouTube, where we are Gemstone Mine Podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at Gemstone Mine MTG, or you can send us an email, where we are gemstonemindpodcast@gmail.com. But you probably want to start with one of the first two places first, as there's a little bit more content in the first two than by emailing us.
Okay, and again, what do you guys do on your podcast? What's your focus?
So a lot of what we did early on eventually led us to trying to identify ourselves as being that bridge between people who were interested in more, I guess you'd say, casual or battlecruiser type games, but we're trying to bring more of what could potentially be seen as more powerful. We had all had quite a bit of experience playing in CDH games, but we also still enjoyed the more casual end of the spectrum as well. As a result, we wanted to be that bridge and say, hey, there are things that even if you never want to see Thassa's Oracle and Demonic Consultation resolve at your table, there are still things you can take away from those more high-powered games to make you have better games even at low-power tables.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to take this moment to say Gemstone Mine is an amazing name for a podcast, given the fact it's actually very CDH viable.
Well, don't tell anybody, but our episode background is actually Gemstone Caverns, which is more CDH viable.
Hey, I mean, I was just thinking about that this morning before, hours before we were recording. It's like, you know, Gemstone Mine is actually really good. Just maybe not so much in a two-color deck, but as long as you go three or more colors, that's some pretty good stuff.
I remember the good old days. I've been playing long enough that I strictly remember going through with Gemstone Mine lines where you could use it to get all your colors of mana, and then when you went to remove the last point, you could sacrifice the counter, and the good old days.
All right. So, like I said a couple moments ago, today's episode of the podcast is going to be John and I discussing why having a range of decks from that more casual, low-power battlecruiser, however you want to call it, level, all the way up to high-power casual, potentially CEDH levels especially, could be really important for you at your next game event, whether that's just hanging out with friends, going to a local LGS, getting together some sort of convention. So John, you had some interesting thoughts coming into the episode that we talked about in the pre-show. Would you like to get started on some of those notes and we'll just see where it flows from there?
Sure thing. So at the end of the day, a lot of us, especially if you're in deep enough to the Commander community that you're consuming some Commander podcasts, you probably really enjoy Commander. You probably want to play more games of Commander. And having decks at different levels, whether they be that casual battlecruiser, whether it be CDH or anything in between, means there are more potential opponents for you to play against and more potential pods for you to form. At the end of the day, Sheldon Mannery, the godfather of the format, has been talking a lot recently about where it's less about what your deck does and more about when your deck does it. Another way that I've seen it put is from another great content creator who does a lot of work in CEDH, Rebel Sun. And she has argued that it really comes down to the intent that you bring when you're brewing your deck or when you're playing the game. So much so that I've quoted her multiple times where if you brew with intent, if you come to the game with the intent that you are going to play a CDH game, you can bring just about any commander to the table as long as you've built that deck with the intent of being ready for the critical turn and the clock that CDH games represent. Mm-hmm. I think that same philosophy can be applied at all the different levels throughout the entire spectrum of Commander.
Yeah, that's actually a really good insight there, John. I definitely agree with you on a lot of that, actually all of it, because again, when you look at things from, as I have in all the episodes that I've done, the same pattern comes up that you really, when you're first building a deck, that is really the perfect time to figure out exactly what you want to do with it. I mean, again, I'm going to utilize my example of my most recent deck, my Alenda CDH deck, which, again, if you've listened to my episode, the last episode I had up on here, the five things I learned about CDH from my first CDH games, you'll learn that it was kind of a more of a fringe deck, I suppose, and the fact that it has a lot of CDH viable cards in it, but again, it can also scale down a little bit, too. It's not necessarily trying to go full bore. It can, but it doesn't necessarily have to. And originally, I have a more, I guess, more casual version of the deck. It's still more, it's still fairly optimized when you consider a quote-unquote casual play. But when I'm trying to bring that up to a different level, it was with the express intent that I'd be able to try to hang around at a CDH table while also having the opportunity to just say, you know, if I don't want to play necessarily this exact deck with these 100 cards, I also have this version right here that's some of the cards are the same, obviously, but some of the other cards are watered down, I suppose. That's the difference from taking a $6,300 deck to, I guess, like a $200 deck, you know, if you want to do strictly monetarily, but the intent is very different. The high power casual deck, I want to be able to do a lot of the same combos, a lot of the same things, but it's more focused on running things maybe at sorcery speed, maybe not so efficiently, whereas the CDH version of the deck is running the best tutors. It's running the best lines, and it's really going in there with the intent to try to be able to hang at that level. And I think that right there is the difference, really.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, I'm just going to very briefly define what I kind of see as the critical turn of CDH, and in truth, it changes. In the Turbo Nos meta, which is people trying to cast ad nauseum as quickly as their decks would allow, as early as turn two a lot of the time, that metagame had a much quicker critical turn than the metagame that we're seeing now in CDH, where you have a lot slower, more mid-range decks, a lot more stacks based around rule of law. This has led to the critical turn probably backing up a little bit. But at the end of the day, if you're not ready for someone to be able to threaten to win the game or put themselves into such a dominating position that their victory is basically inevitable by turn 2 to 3 to 4, then you've not approached that metagame with the proper intent. And I'm looking at your Alenda the Dust Rose deck now. You've got your Broken Mana Rocks, you've got your Mox Diamond, you've got your Jeweled Lotus. You are ready to go to get as much mana online as soon as possible, get yourself into the game, and be ready for when everyone else is trying to jam their wins.
Yeah, now I think the biggest problem with this in this specific case is I'm just still so new to the format that it unfortunately knocks my pilot skill down. And that's just something that takes time to learn, understand what's a good keepable hand and what's not. But you're right, the intent is there to at least try to be more competitive. It's just, it's going to require more experience to really learn how to pilot it efficiently to get the best out of those efficient and optimized cards.
And at the end of the day, experience is for everything. I can remember a time when I was just getting started out, and time for me to date myself a little bit. I remember being very scared of Scaled Worm, which is 8 mana for a 7/6 with nothing on that card but flavor text, because it was so big, and I had no idea how my dorky little 1/1 Banalish hero was going to be able to stop that thing. Eventually, you do get the experience. You learn to recognize what are the things that are actually threatening to you, and then what are the things that you can allow to happen, because even like the most controlling deck in the world in any level of commander is not going to be able to stop everything. At the end of the day, too, I think that idea of intent can be boiled down to just about any type of deck you want to build, from those CEDH levels all the way to, well, my goal is to make sure that I want to be able to hang with my friends who buy their pre-cons once a year. They'll put 5 or 6 cards into it, and that's where they stay. And like, we're getting back to a world where we're going to be able to enjoy Magic Fests again soon. I would love to be able to sit down at a table, watch a father and then his kid pull out their first pre-con decks ever, sleeving them as we sit down to get the pod ready, and say, okay, I can play a game with these nice people too.
Definitely, definitely. So I think now that we've kind of discussed the thesis of this episode, I'm gonna go into a very reasonable question for both of us to answer. So I recently bought a Quiver case. Great case. I love it to death. I can't wait to utilize it more. And effectively, it holds 6 to 7 decks, right? Sleeve, single sleeved. And my question myself has been, okay, I have different decks at different levels, right? Some extremely janky decks, some of which I talk about on this podcast a lot, some kind of in the middle, some that are pretty decent. Alenda low, Alenda optimized, and now Alenda or Selvala CDH. Well, okay, maybe I don't necessarily need to take all of those to any game night because I only have 6 or 7 spots, right? And I guess the question here is, how do you try to determine what decks you necessarily want to put in those 6 or 7? Do you want to try to figure out what you like playing the most, or is it better to potentially have kind of a bell curve where you have something for every situation? I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
My philosophy at the end of the day is it is hard to, the old quote of editing is murdering your darlings. Picking out what decks you want to take to an event is also kind of like editing, where it's like murdering your darlings, where you just don't get to bring all the things you enjoy. For example, between my play groups, I have the play group that I maintain with my co-hosts, Jake and Alex. And a lot of that winds up being CEDH, fringe CEDH, or honestly, pretty darn high power kind of. I feel like in a similar vein to, oh my goodness, I hate your deck. I almost blanked on the name of that, and I feel very bad. Where, for example, Jake's, I think, signature deck in that high power range is his mono red Neheb deck, which is essentially Earthquake and Flame Rift Tribal, and that deck can do some serious damage. I like to have decks that I have built for both those higher power games and for lower power games. And the way that I try to approach it is that even for those low power games, while I'm tr not trying to necessarily build towards something that will be overwhelming, I can still build towards something that makes me happy. And one of the things that really makes me happy is a card called Scrap Trawler.
Oh yes, and
Scrap.
we're not talking about the podcast you're all either, though that is a good one too. So definitely check them
Also,
out.
well, chef's kiss. But Scrap Trawler is just one of my favorite cards in the history of Magic. The ability to just get an engine going of recycling artifact creatures in and out of the graveyard, grinding out that slow, steady value, I just enjoy it so much. I've enjoyed it enough that I've built 2 different decks at relatively different levels, I guess you would say, in the commander format around them. I have my mono white God Eternal Oketra deck, where the goal of the deck is to set up a Scrap Trawler loop and then make a bunch of 4/4 zombie warrior creature tokens, pass the turn, and see if anybody can do anything. At that point, it usually takes a while for me to both get Oketra onto the field and somehow find my artifact creatures multiple in mono white and find a sacrifice outlet. So usually it's like turn 6, 7 before I'm even threatening to do anything like that. On the other hand, I also have a Rakdos Lord of Riots deck, That one, I have jammed in Mox Diamond, Mox Opal, Chrome Mox, all of the fast mana that I can get. I have rituals in there so I can get Rakdos in play as soon as possible, and then try to win by recurring creatures like Walking Ballista and creatures like Hangerback Walker off of the back of Rakdos's cost reduction ability to end the game on the spot. The big difference between the two of them, apart from color identity and apart from how mean looking the commander is that Rakdos is intending to go in to end the game much more quickly, and it has a much smaller, much shorter clock. Where I kind of talk about the clock in a few episodes of Gemstone Mine. To me, the clock is one of the important things to consider when you're looking at the intent of how you're brewing your deck. Mono White Oketra, the clock is pretty reasonable unless I've somehow managed to go infinite and make an infinite number of 4/4s. Most likely, I'm going to make 2 to 3 4/4 zombies a turn and pass the turn. It's going to take me a while to be able to beat down any one opponent. I often will say, it's 3 to 4 turns on the clock for that deck. In my mind, the clock is a critical thing to consider, because if you can present your deck to the table and say, it will not kill you in one turn, it's not going to combo out the table. It's a very different intent for the game. Where if we sat down together and we're playing the game, and I tell you that my Oketra deck, this one, MJ, you're okay. There are going to be times when I'm going to build up a big board of creatures, but it's going to be something that happens over multiple turns. Whereas if we were having a Rule Zero conversation and I was bringing Rakdos out, well, they both have the same core engine built around Scrap Trawler. I would say Rakdos has a chance where, if I can get Rakdos to stick on the board, I can end the game and eliminate all my opponents before I pass the turn to the next person. And I think that's a different expectation that people around the table would have. So I would tell you that the clock on Rakdos is 0, whereas the clock on Oketra is 3 to 4 turns.
Yeah, and this really comes back to the intent thing, as we were just talking about a few moments ago, is Rakdos is intending to be able to have the pieces in place to be able to win in theory on the spot, whereas Oketra needs to have more momentum. It opens itself up to more interaction. I mean, there's something. An unfortunate misnomer in the more casual circles that more casual players don't run a lot of interaction. And I really think that's a falsehood. I play a lot of interaction in my more casual decks, partially because of my own personal playgroup where we love to run a lot of board wipes, et cetera, but also because there are just important things you need to get rid of. And it's just that that interaction looks very different than at the more optimized levels. There's a lot more board wipes, it's slower wipes, it's less of your Wrath of God, it's more kind of your, what is it, Decree of Pain, I think, that
Oh, good
eight
old Decree
cost,
of
yep,
Pain.
an 8-cost board wipe that allows you to then draw a card for each creature that's destroyed. Well, in a more optimized game, you're probably not going to necessarily see this cast unless there's a really way, a good way to be able to power it out, right, with your fast mana, et cetera, et cetera. In that case, something like Damnation would probably be a better card because it's 2 black-black to do the same thing. What Decree of Pain provides is kind of just more that like timely value to be able to just keep your deck helming along in a meta where you can afford to be able to utilize 8 mana on a board wipe to also draw some cards. And yeah.
Which, and I think that's a perfect example of the two of them. That also kind of gets to the idea of that critical turn. I mentioned before that, like in CDH, you're looking at a critical turn that's like 2.5 to 3.5. People are going to be going for it very, very early in the course of a game. However, when you're getting to games where you're looking at less efficient cards, and everybody is expecting that that's going to be the intent, let's get real. If you can reasonably expect that no one's going to beat you to death before you get to 8 mana, I would much rather wipe the board and draw 20 cards than just wipe the board. I mean, you're speaking my language there, MJ.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I see when I go through and I build my decks. Because again, John, you and I are not very different in a lot of ways, but we also like to brew in, and I would say very different ends of the spectrum too. I mean, again, we both like to brew both lower power and higher powered. But again, I definitely make my hay at the casual and the battlecruiser levels. So I guess my card evaluation might be a little bit different. But where we do agree on is just the fact that you can get away with some of those kinds of cards at the lower power levels, because you just have that ability to say, hey, I'm free to be able to do this, right?
Oh, yeah. It's whatever they can let you get away with, you should get away with, in terms of how much value you're able to extract from a single card. If you're running in a metagame slow enough that you can run Fumigate over Wrath of God, hey, that's a little bit of extra life padding your life total. If you're running in a metagame where you can easily get away with Decree of Pain, hey, those are more cards in hand.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely, definitely. And the list really goes on down the list when you look at that kind of interaction. Again, I have my own black kill spells that I love to use in a more casual level, which maybe won't necessarily work in a more optimized level. I'm looking at Tragic Slip is a classic case of I just like that card. It doesn't always work, but it's nice to have in a pinch, especially when my playgroup does run a lot of targeted removal. Maybe not as fast as a more optimized meta would have, but we still have a fair share of our Swords to Plowshares, Path to Exile, et cetera, where, you know, oh, okay, those are Exile, but it just, you know, kill spells instead. The Vindicate, Terminate, trying to remember these off the top of my head. There's just so many. They all sound the same.
Vindicate, Utter End, Anguished Unmaking.
Yeah. But yeah, it just sometimes you can try to find little ways to get an advantage on there, kind of depend. But again, it's all meta dependent. It's
exactly.
Yeah. So it's a little weird trying to jump into a deck from the first thing if you don't necessarily have a play group in mind to try to figure out exactly what you want to put in there. But again, that all goes back to intent. What are you necessarily trying to do? And that right there ultimately drives your card choices.
It 100% does. And I think we've both had similar experiences sometimes what draws us to the deck is the commander. I recently talked on an episode about Galta Primal Hunger. And what drew me to that commander was, okay, this is a big 12-12 trampler who gets easier to cast the more creatures you control. I want to build a storm deck with it. Or you might be drawn to something where you go, huh, you know, Bolas's Citadel is a really cool card.
Really?
I wonder what I could do. I wonder what I could do if I built my entire game plan around that old hidden commander idea. Mm. Or sometimes it's just, I really love zombies. I want to make a zombie deck. Let me see who I can find to head this thing. And each one of those is its own unique approach to building a deck. And it kind of informs what the intent of the deck is going to be. For example, if we were to say, let's go back to Bolas's Citadel for a second.
Okay.
You can probably very easily come up with an idea where you're going to play a deck and your goal is from Bolas's Citadel, you're going to summon a swarm of life-linking angels so you can get your life back and keep the good times coming out of this Citadel. On the other hand, you could very easily take Bolas's Citadel and make it one of your aces in the hole in a CDH deck, almost like another form of Ad Nauseam, where it is powerful enough to power you through multiple cards in a turn. It can make a big difference at a lot of different tables.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what your intent that you're, what do you expect to do with it? One of the best pieces of advice I ever received for trying to help somebody build a deck is, what does your deck look like when you're going for it? When you're going for the win, when everything is humming, when things are coming up Millhouse, what does your deck look like? And then help them build around that. For some people, it's, well, I'm going to cast Ad Nauseam. I'm going to get 12 broken mana rocks. I'm going to cast Thassa's Oracle and Demonic Consultation. And that is great. For some people, it's going to be, I bet I can make Najeela work with no colored lands. And that's great, too. For me, it's how many times can I cast a creature off a Scrap Trawler? And each one of those kind of informs what your intent with the deck is going to be. It's one of the reasons why I've really enjoyed my mono white Oketra deck, which is why I don't mind breaking it out, even though it is probably one of the weaker decks that I have. Because even when I'm getting my teeth kicked in with that deck, I'm still often enjoying myself looping creatures in and out of the graveyard. Yes, I love the old necromancy. trying to put together weird little lines to just get one extra zombie warrior in a turn. So even if Korvald is flying over and kicking me in the face, so be it. I still enjoyed myself.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Colorless Najeela there. I wonder if anyone, I wonder who did that actually. Could be Bueller. Bueller? No, yeah. So, I agree with everything you're saying here, John. It's really good to know exactly what your end game is when you're trying to build the deck, and that really is one of the keys when you're trying to build anything. It doesn't matter what level of optimization you're going for. It's just, but knowing where you want to go with the deck is usually a good first step, I'd say, after you've probably picked your commander. If But again, you could build it very differently, is you could build it around a win condition and then try to say, well, this commander allows me to do X. I suppose I could run X. I mean, I know that your experiences with Bolas's Citadel are probably very different than mine, but again, both of them are very valid, very correct. It just really matters on what you're trying to get out of that particular card and what you're looking to do with that card in your 99 of your particular deck, doesn't matter what it is.
Right, and I could just as easily replace Bolas's Citadel as the example with one of my all-time pet cards, Dreams of the Dead. Have you ever heard of this ridiculous card, MJ?
I maybe have, but read it out for everybody so that they know what we're talking about.
All right, Dreams of the Dead is an enchantment from all the way back in Ice Age. It is a blue enchantment for 3 and a blue with the activated ability 1 and a blue. Return target white or black creature card from your graveyard to the battlefield. That creature gains cumulative upkeep 2. If the creature would leave the battlefield, exiled instead of putting it anywhere else.
Okay,
So
yes, I
essentially.
have heard of this card. For everyone has known, I just forgot what it was called.
Oh, you'll recognize it immediately with that excellent Ice Age art. But this card has. I have come back to this so many times trying to build a deck where this is basically the hidden commander, where I'm trying to get my value off of Orzhov, black and blue creatures, out of the graveyard. Blinking them with Amanatu in the command zone, using the mono white partner from Commander Legends who can exile creatures for you with Aegis counters on them until you bring
Livio,
them back
Oathsworn
later.
Sentinel.
Yes, thank you very much. I've tried so many different ways to make this beautiful card work, and none of them involve me winning the game. At most of them involve me grinding out a little bit more value off of Cloud Blazer, or a little bit more value off of one of the Orzhov Angels or Archon of Ashen Rider, that's the
Ashen
name of
Rider,
it.
yeah.
And I love that just as much as I love trying to put together lines with Underworld Breach in CEDH. But I don't think I could ever try to bring Dreams of the Dead to a CEDH game with any kind of a straight face. Just like I don't think I could say, oh no, my Thassa's Oracle deck is perfect for playing against these precons.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit problematic on so many levels. But again, it comes back to intent, right? I mean, in theory, you could throw Thassa's Oracle into any deck and have it be perfectly fair.
Absolutely. And it does come down to the intent. Is your goal with that card that once in a great while, if the game has gone long, and your self-mill package has gone right, yes, you can win it as you can run it as a win con, but most of the time it's just there in your Merfolk deck, look at the top 6 cards of your library and pick one of them that's going to help your game plan. It's one of the
Yeah.
reasons why I don't always think that Thassa's Oracle needs to be banned, even if it beats me on a regular basis every weekend.
Yeah, so I will use the example of my mono blue deck that I built for a very casual reason for my regular play group. And the crux of the deck was, well, I don't really have a blue deck and I want to draw some cards. So what can I do to just, draw a whole bunch of cards? And I built the deck around some interesting effects, draw cards, mill people out, but do it in a very slow, controlled manner, kind of haphazardly, I suppose. And I do run Lab Man in there because, if I do somehow manage to deck myself, I can win the game. But I'm not looking to tutor for Lab Man. I just kind of have him in there as a creature. If I don't have him, that's fine. He's not the point of the deck. He's just, you know, kind of a weird auxiliary piece to a deck that really more cares more about drawing cards, buffing creatures that care about drawing cards, and then making said large creatures unblockable and beating people's faces in. So, again, another example of where something like that, where you can take a combo piece like Labman, who's very well known, very notorious for this sort of thing, and kind of nerf them, I suppose, to just bring them into alignment with what the deck is trying to do. I can't draw my whole deck in one instance. It'll take me like 10 to 12 turns to probably do that, playing this, that, and the other thing. But yeah, it's just, he's in there, but he's not really what I'm trying to do. And yeah, it's definitely interesting just thinking about that at different levels, especially with Thassa's Oracle, is you can run that card in so many different ways that if I was to run Thassa's Oracle in that same blue deck, I could probably scry, I don't know, 6-7 cards, and that would actually be quite useful at that level, while also giving me a win condition if I needed one too.
Right, and I think that plays a big part into it. You've probably heard stories about people saying, well, I don't know, this can't really be a deck that's meant for casual. I mean, look, it has a Mana Crypt in it, or it has a Demonic Tutor in it. At the same time, I don't think you can really rob that player their experience of, I did it. I opened a Strixhaven pack, and I got a Mystical Archive Demonic Tutor. This is the centerpiece of my collection. I'm going to put it into my green-black deck that I built, almost entirely otherwise out of draft commons and uncommons. That Demonic Tutor in that kind of deck is not something that's being used alongside four other unrestricted black tutors to go get a win condition. A lot of times in that deck, that's something that someone is using to go get the card that makes five pests, because that's what the deck wants to do. Or it's going to go get a piece of interaction, like trying to get the Reclamation Sage that player just got for their birthday. Or maybe they're finally getting ready to close out the game, and now they can finally live the dream of getting Colossification on their Toski.
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes down to, yes, if at that point you're putting in four different unconditional tutors, seven different zero mana rocks, and you're also putting in all the fast mana and all the broken card advantage that you can find, that's a different type of intent than someone who's simply saying, this really cool and powerful card, I'm going to put it into my deck, because this is the chance I get to play it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. It reminds me of my joke story about where my Demonic Tutor used to lie before it ended up in my casual optimized Alenda deck. It was kind of the joke card in my super budget Voltron build, where and I know I've talked about this on the show a few times before, but I'll say it again. Effectively, it's a deck that, you know, without a couple of pieces would be about 15, 20 bucks total. And I basically just had fun casting Demonic Tutor there because I had it in my collection, and the joke was I can Demonic Tutor for a 10 cents common somewhere. And, you know, that was the joke. It's like, it's a budget deck, except it also runs Demonic Tutor. And, so, yeah.
So why don't we break that down a little bit then? The whole idea of Demonic Tutor, one of the reasons why it's something that's feared in more powerful metagames like in CEDH, is that for a very small amount of investment of mana, it allows you to very quickly get to a very powerful line. Whether that line is, I'm going to get two more mana for free off of a Mana Crypt, which I am expected to have in this deck, or I'm going to go get the other half of a major combo piece, or I'm going to get a card like Ad Nauseam, which could let me draw up to 20 to 30 cards, at which point I'm just going to win the game anyway. On the other hand, in the scenario you described, you get to sit there and smile as you look at your Demonic Tutor and say, yeah, I think right now what we're looking for, we're looking to give this creature unblockable. Or give this creature fear. Or give it a turtle shell. Whatever it may be, whatever strikes you at that moment, the intent of the card in that particular deck is transformed. It is completely different than the expectation might be in another deck.
Mm-hmm. Trying to remember what I normally would try to find with that Demonic Tutor. Probably something like Swiftfoot Boots. Okay. Oh, right. Cranial Plating. There we go.
Ah, Cranial Plating. Now, that is a good one there.
But yeah, I mean, that's about as good as the deck's going to get. I mean, not saying Cranial Planing isn't a good card. I mean, it's busted in the right deck. But mm-hmm. again, it needs other cards to be powerful, too. So it's like one of those things where I can get the ball rolling utilizing Demonic Tutor to find Cranial Plating, after which I have hopefully already played two or three other artifacts, in which case now that Cranial Plating really gets going. That ball gets rolling, and then the deck works from there. But again, I don't need that Demonic Tutor in that deck for it to work. It still works fairly well on its own, because I am running a lot of decent blue effects. I'm running the Impulse effects. I'm running Opt, you know, just some of the really cheap ways to kind of churn through my deck, find when I need, but also not necessarily try to do this as efficiently as possible. I mean, again, I did a version of this exact same deck without the more powerful versions of these things, and I get it down to like, oh, okay, TCG player says it's $40, but that was never the intent.
Understood. And another thing that I find can be extremely helpful in this kind of a mental workout is the idea of being able to punch up with your deck. For example, we were talking before the show just about how good old-fashioned cards like Swords to Plowshares and Path to Exile can be. And they are really, really good. They are good whether you are sitting down for a very casual game where you are going to be exiling somebody's Scaled Worm, maybe, or whether you're going to use them to exile somebody's Laboratory Maniac or their Nagila. They have that same powerful impact for the same low price, no matter what sort of game you're looking at. And one of the ways you can pump up your deck to be able to punch up is to change your package of interaction to make it a little bit more efficient. If you only have a small number of decks, that allows you to really maintain the core of what makes your deck special to you, while also enabling you to have the option to pivot and play with decks that do have that lower critical turn, that are trying to do things with greater efficiency, that are less interested in the variety of gameplay and are looking for a higher degree of consistency. You still get to maintain that heart of what makes your deck special to you, while still giving you the option to be included in games like that.
Okay, so that actually reminds me of something that I was gonna, a really good idea I had during our pre-show, and I guess the next question we should probably discuss here for a moment or two is, do you think it's easier to build a more optimized deck and try to be able to bring it down to the level of a pod, or do you think it's easier to, in your opinion, to be able to try to punch up a weight class, where you take your deck and you try to deal with decks that are more optimized, more efficient than yours by maybe making a few changes to the deck, but otherwise the guts of it are fairly middling compared to the rest of the other decks at the table?
I personally think it's easier to pump punch up than it is to tune a deck down. Now, I say this having one of the tabs that's open on my browser right now being trying to tune down some of the work that the Mind Sculptors did on a recent episode where they were brewing around humility and trying to tune down those CEDH decks to work at a more casual pod, just because I think some of the stuff that they're doing is kind of neat, but I don't necessarily want to do it at the CEDH level with those particular types of decks. That said, I do think that it's much easier to take a deck that you already feel invested in and you already enjoy and then tune it around the edges, because in most cases, with a few exceptions, I don't think we're really wedded to just which cards we picked to be our suite of interaction or our mana rocks. It was one of the reasons why I didn't shed a lot of tears a few years ago when Arcane Signet was printed and made a lot of different mana rocks, frankly, irrelevant for most of us. Because at the end of the day, I don't come to the table to show you a unique gameplay experience. And sure, you could say, oh, wow, look at that great mana rock. I haven't seen one of those before. Usually it's going to be something outside of that realm. I think it's the same with a lot of interaction. I don't think people are going to be blown away by a lot of the interaction that we play. Well, the players may not anyway. Hopefully their creatures and their threats will be. But I think that interaction can be more agnostic, with a few exceptions. allowing you to be able to hold up a smaller amount of mana and still be able to interact with what your opponents are trying to do. Trimming things down from a 2-mana disenchant to a 1-mana Nature's Claim, a single green mana to destroy an artifact or enchantment while giving somebody a little bit of life in exchange.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And again, in the deck that I was just describing, my super cheap Voltron deck, I do run very high-costed counter spells because I want to make sure that at the lower power pods, I'm not trying to stop people from playing the game. Again, it all comes back to intent, so I try to handicap myself a little bit by running some very less than stellar counter spells in there, and not running very many of them. But if I did want to try to bring that up, I could very easily even just trade some of those very inefficient counter spells for even something like a negate, and that already brings up the efficiency of the deck considerably over a 3 or 4 mana counter spell. Just little things like that can make a huge difference.
And they absolutely can. And it's really cool too, because it's not just learning from CEDH. You can learn a lot from what people are doing at the quote unquote low powers as well. I built an Orvar mono blue merfolk deck where I'm not running, I think, more than one or two counter spells in my mono blue deck because I wanted to be able to use other things to replicate the idea of a counter spell. And a lot of times, people are running cards that will give creatures hexproof as a way to protect them. And they also happen to target a creature. So if I target one of my merfolk lords and make it temporarily hexproof to negate a spell like Swords to Plowshares, and I get a copy of it off of Orvar's triggered ability, well, yeah, that's what I want that deck to be able to do. That's what that deck looks like when it's going for it. So in that case, if I had to sacrifice that part of it, I think I can cut a few of those out and make room for more powerful counter spells, more efficient ones, to allow me to play with the more high-powered decks in our group. But that deck was brewed with the intent of being able to sit down with the people who are building upgraded precons or decks that are built more with commons and uncommons out of a draft pile. But that concept is still there. I still have the option to add the additional counters, the additional interaction, if I'm going to say it's time for me to step up with the big boys. Or if the other players in our group begin to up their game as one of the new players in our deck has a Riona the Fire Dancer deck, and she comboed us out on turn 5 2 weeks ago. They're coming along, and they're coming for.
Okay, so now that we've talked about kind of trying to find different deficiency levels, trying to figure out exactly where you want your deck to fall, I think it only makes sense at the end of the episode here to kind of go through our own personal deck lists and kind of choose some of the decks we would probably take to a table in my quiver example.
All right,
So
so we got
let, yeah.
six slots, you said?
6 or 7. I mean, I'm able to fit 7 into mine as long as I take my precon, which is unsleeved.
Okay.
So, but 6 is probably fair. So let's start at the beginning or the high end of the spectrum. Let's start with CEDH to high power, casual to fringe CEDH.
All
What
right.
would you take to just any old event? Granted that you think there's a possibility that there's going to be people there who would like to play CDH, or at the very least would have decks that would kind of fit at the fringe level.
Okay, so I think at that point, then I would be playing my Malcolm Kettis Polymorph deck. It is the deck that I recently got into the CDH decklist database. I was very happy about
Oh,
that.
nice. Nice.
And,
Congratulations.
well, thank you. And this deck is my baby, where I have partnered up Malcolm Kenai Navigator with Kettis Emberclaw Familiar. Kettis makes your commander deal damage to everybody every time it deals combat damage to any opponent. So that means every time Malcolm hits one opponent for combat damage, Kettis lets you deal 2 damage to each other opponent and then get 3 treasures out of the deal. So getting not one Lotus Petal every turn, but 3 Lotus Petals was very fun. And that deck tries to run no other creatures except for Glinthorn Buccaneer, which is a 2-card combo with Malcolm, and a lot of polymorph effects to get Glinthorn Buccaneer out quickly. I think that would be the CDH deck I'd bring with me.
All right. And on my end, I would bring either of the decks that I've already mentioned, either Alenda or Selvala, depending on which one I'm feeling more bullish on at the moment. So I guess for me, it'd be a little bit easier. But that's because I'm a little less invested in that end of the spectrum right now. But that is changing. I'm working on it. So that could come back to me in like 6 months to 12 months here, and it might be completely different. I don't know. We'll see.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So moving on, we now have one slot taken up. The next one, I think, would be if we're going on the same concept that we're probably taking a range of decks, right? That's the whole point of the show. What would be kind of the next step down from that level? We've talked about CDH, Fringe, CDH. What would be kind of the next deck you would take? Would that be like a Fringe deck? Would that be High Power Casual? Or would you just kind of just go with whatever?
Yeah, so at that point, I'm looking at a deck that's probably more of a critical turn of like 4 to 5 as opposed to like 2.5 to 3.5. You're still going to be running a lot of powerful forms of ramp. You're still looking to play powerful cards and efficient interaction. And for me, I think I would probably bring my deck that is Kadama of the East Tree partnered with Krom Ludovic's Opus.
Gross.
And it turned into a Teemer Landfall deck.
Gross.
Because when you have a landfall deck with Kadama in the command zone, Kadama makes it so every time a landfall token, such as off of Field of the Dead, comes into play, you put another land from your hand into play. And you get another token and put another land into play. And when basically everything else in your deck is trying to draw you cards to fill your hand up for Kadama, yeah, the phrase, I vomited my hand onto the field and a bunch of zombies, that's the dream of that deck.
Yeah, my head is spinning after the last time I played against Kodama. That got out of hand very quickly.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And Kodama is one of those cards where it's actually sneaky powerful, especially if you play it, I guess, a more casual table. That was my last experience. And I just remember the individual who was playing that apologizing to all of us after the game because just I didn't know this could be so powerful. That card can take over games easily.
It easily could.
Yeah. Okay, so on my end, I would probably take, again, Alenda 2. I guess I have to call it Alenda 1 and Alenda 2 now. the deck I do have in full form with all the cards that are actually in my collection. The optimized version, not the CDH version. And again, like I mentioned, this one wants to do everything that the CDH deck wants to do, but it does it at a slower pace. I am running sorcery speed tutors instead of running the instant speed tutors. I'm running Idyllic Tutor instead of Vampiric Tutor. A couple of different weird little... right now my deck has Foreboding Fruit in it, which is it was from Eldraine. Target player draws 2 cards and loses 2 life and has adamant, so you can create a food token out of it, which seems kind of cool, I suppose. Trying to kind of mix and matching with the board wipes a little bit. Just doing the same thing, but not as efficiently. It's still running a lot of really, really, really good cards, but it's also running things like Skullclamp, which with Alenda are just really good. They don't necessarily fit in the CDH version of this deck, but, you know, that, Bolas's Citadel, plus a couple of more of Alenda-centric combos, which I don't necessarily have room to run in the CDH version, make it a different play experience at the end of the day versus what the CDH deck is trying to do. I guess I have more flexibility with this version because I can run either any of the combos in there that are sitting in there, which are between both decks, but I can also lean more into Alenda as a commander too. And that's kind of a nice little way that I can kind of have both ways with these decks is I can run the combos, but I can also just kind of grind it out in a nice mid-range tempo deck too.
That sounds like a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I just really like Alenda for some reason. It's the kind of commander, she's the kind of commander who looks kind of unassuming, but also just vomits value. And I love that. The jank brewer in me loves just like finding silly little niche things to deal with this deck, while also being able to run up the the optimization level too. So it's like it can hang with powerful decks, but in a way, I think I could run this deck at a middling power level too and be just fine.
Right, right. And actually, the next deck that I would put into my theoretical quiver is probably going to be a little bit slower on some draws than the Krom Kadama deck I mentioned a moment ago, and that's my Mono Red Torbran deck.
Oh, yes.
Affectionately called Torbran's off-brand Super Friends, but at this point, I have caught a lot of the Super Friends package, so I'm down to only 5 Planeswalkers left in the deck. But Torbran has a mighty quick clock. While the deck doesn't run a lot of powerful mana rocks to reliably get Torbran out early, it's often looking at turn 4 at least to get Torbran on the field and have things set up. Once Torbran is on the field, it's not too surprising if the deck two-shots a particular opponent. It's never going to completely wipe all opponents off the board in a single massive attack, because a lot of what it's doing is dropping smaller goblins or goblin tokens where I can get 2, maybe 3 bodies out of a particular card. Then I'm magnifying the damage off of enchantments like Cavalcade of Calamity, which is going to deal a point of damage whenever a creature with power 1 or less attacks. Well, Torbran is going to turn that 1 damage that the Cavalcade of Calamity deals into 3 damage, and the 1 damage the token will deal when it connects into 3 damage. So it amplifies that damage very nicely. But at the end of the day, the way that I've tried to keep it from being too oppressive and too quick for the games that I'm looking to play with the deck is that instead of running Mox Diamond, Mox Opal, and Chrome Mox, I'm instead running Fire Diamond and Mindstone and much slower forms of ramp in this particular deck to make sure that the threat of Torbran isn't becoming active until later in the game.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And again, it all comes back down to intent. Fire Diamond is a perfectly fair Magic card, and people should be playing it more.
Especially when you have a shiny one.
Ooh, fancy, fancy. Yeah, so for my kind of, I guess, middling deck, I suppose, I've always considered that my Alayla Artful Provocateur deck is kind of in that vein, is that for a while there, it was one of my most powerful decks. Then I tore my most powerful ones apart because I didn't really enjoy them. So I think she's kind of she, for a while, inherited the title of quote-unquote most optimized deck on my end. Effectively, it's just jammed full of really low-cost artifacts and enchantments, a lot of interaction, honestly. Artifacts that protect her, draw cards. I do run Mystic Forge in there for what it's worth. Just trying to get a whole bunch of fairies out and then beat face with them. So it's just a really low to the ground, and not necessarily as aggro as I would like it to be. But again, I'm still trying to find exactly what I want to do with that deck and how I want to run it. But it works fairly well. I have ways to ping people. I really should be. I don't know why I'm not running Marionette Master in this deck. I just thought about that. That needs to change. But yeah.
The curse of the content creator looking at their list during an episode. Why am I not doing this?
Yeah, because I have one in my collection. I've gone by it like 20 times and it's never been, hey, you know, I should play that in Alayla. Oh man, what am I doing with my life?
Well, I think you're putting Marionette Master into Alayla is what you're doing.
Yeah. But again, what's fun about Alayla is, yes, I do run more efficient cards. I do try to run... I mean, I am running Path to Exile. I am running Swords to Plowshares. Negate, again, since I don't necessarily have a one-mana counter spell in my collection. But just... I do still run pet cards in this deck. I will never not throw my biggest... Friendo Darksteel Juggernaut into this deck. I just love that card. It does a lot of work, and if nothing else, it's funny, even if it's the only artifact I have on the field. Because it's indestructible, it has to attack, and I just love that. So, just being able to punch above its class if I'm able to get a good hand is also kind of counterbalanced by just being able to play a whole bunch of really silly creatures in here. Okay, I shouldn't say necessarily silly creatures. I don't think you can call Metalworker silly, but and again, for everyone out there listening, it's unfortunately not the reserved list version. This is the World Championship decks version. So you know, don't think that I'm just running out here with $150 cards in my decks. I'm not that big of a high roller.
There's no gold border shaming while I'm here.
I know. It's just I don't want people thinking that I'm an extreme high roller. Okay.
Okay.
But this deck, it's fun to play. Sometimes it kind of bothers me. It's like I'm still not quite sure exactly where I want to go with deck. I'm constantly tinkering with it, but if it does its thing, it can punch people pretty easily. It's mostly just the problem I end up getting mana screwed a lot with this deck, so it doesn't get played as much as it should be. I think that's been the biggest impediment for me.
Well, if there's a deck that we're currently like really tinkering with, I guess the next deck that goes in, I would slot in below Torbran, would be an Abzan deck I built around Kolfinir the Last U. So this is the commander from Commander Legend who is able to bring creatures back out of the graveyard when a creature dies, as long as the creature who died has a higher toughness than the card you're getting back out of the graveyard. So what I did with this deck was I wanted this to be my +1/+1 counters deck. Part of me loves +1/+1 counters. I love seeing big numbers and having, here's my 25/25 crashing in. I don't think any of us ever truly outgrow that. At the same time, I don't like the manual dexterity of managing +1/+1 counters on multiple cards all night long. So this is a deck that I would pull out occasionally, usually for one or two games. Those +1/+1 counters mean that my creature that started out as a 1/1 but died as a 6/6 can get back any of the other 1/1s or 2/2s that have already died that game. Allows me to synergize with what my commander is doing. And you may be detecting a theme here that I really like the graveyard and grinding value of it, and Kolfinir lets me do it very well. Mostly, this deck doesn't start to do much until turns 5 to 6 when Kolfinir hits the table. And then, unless I have a very particular card, like Mana Gorge or Hydra, which gets big very quickly and has trample, I'm usually not threatening to knock anybody out for at least 3 to 4 turns. It's got a relatively slow clock to it. I did take advantage of a lot of the powerful removal that you get when you're in Abzan, running all the cards from Vindicate to Utter End to Anguished Unmaking. I'm also running a number of creatures who have either Enter the Battlefield or Sacrifice effects to destroy artifacts or enchantments. Cards like Good Old Fashioned Reclamation Sage, cards like Knight of Autumn from our most recent visit to Ravnica. And I'm actually running more of them recently because I've had Kolfinir get beat down by Korvald more than a few times, and having more interaction, well, that's what the deck wound up needing. I do tell people when I break this deck out that it is running Aura Shards in there, because it is a powerful way to close out the game and clear out artifacts and enchantments if I can get it to stick. But I also don't have any way to tutor Aura Shards out, and it's not the primary game plan of the deck.
Mm-hmm. You know, I never would have thought that you'd like the graveyard. Okay, so for my fourth deck, I kind of waffle between a couple of them, honestly, here. I mean, just going through my Moxfield profile, I feel like this is kind of the flex slot for me, is that there's a couple of decks that would go in this, so I'd need a little bit of extra thought. But it would either come down to two of my most signature decks, I think. Either running Kothfed Soul Hoarder, who is my demon boy. I just love that deck to death because, you know, people say, well, you die as a Smothering Tide. And I'm like, I don't care. It's still funny. And it's like, I don't like to die to permanence. You know, here's calling out Uzainum for killing me one time with Kothfed on the field. But I just love that deck because it's so full of just kind of weird cards that, you know, it turns heads, and I just love that deck to death. The other deck that I would consider for the slot would be my Selenia Dark Angel deck. And again, it's one of my other favorite cards, and it does run Bolas' Citadel. And it has an extremely high mana curve, which is kind of unfortunate, but I just jammed it with a whole bunch of really powerful cards, and, you know, high mana cards anyway, and try to win via attrition, I guess. You know, try to see if I can splash some big spells on there and just see what happens. It's kind of a Selenia deck that no one ever sees coming because they have no clue what she does. And then I kind of proceed to just, you know, draw a bunch of lands and then probably end up losing because I can't play my stuff, right? But, yeah. So look out, if I get my Bolas' Citadel, I might be able to actually play two or three spells in a turn. Ha! Yeah, so it's a fun deck, though, because when it does get rolling, it can really be a house. When it doesn't get rolling, it doesn't necessarily do a lot of things. So it's kind of a hit or a miss, but it really goes along with my philosophy of, you know, just put in a big bunch of big splashy stuff. Hopefully it works, right?
Yeah, and I think my deck that would be most similar to that that I put in the number five slot is that God Eternal Oketra deck that I mentioned before, where I'm trying to use God Eternal Oketra, looping Scrap Trawler triggers off of things like Mirror Retriever over and over out of the graveyard, and God Eternal Oketra's trigger is making those 4/4 zombie warrior tokens. Now, as anyone who's ever played Mono White can tell you, it is not easy to assemble multiple combo pieces, even if they are artifact creatures, in Mono White. So what usually winds up happening instead is I grind a little bit of value off cards that are both creatures and either interaction or value. Cards like the recently printed Ambitious Farmhand from Midnight Hunt, which gets you a planes when it enters the battlefield. Or cards like Palace Jailer, which can exile a creature and make you the Monarch when it enters the battlefield. With God Eternal Oketra, they also just come with a 4/4 Vigilant Zombie Warrior creature token stapled to them. Similar to what you described with your deck, it doesn't always get to do its thing where I get a loop and make an infinite number of zombie warriors. In fact, that rarely happens. But even just making myself an extra 2 to 3 zombie warriors a turn, maybe getting 1 or 2 loops going every third game, that's still pretty satisfying in its own way.
Mm-hmm. For the number 5 slot in my hypothetical quiver, I think there's no question about what would end up going in there. It's actually one of my newest decks, but also one of my new favorite decks. And stop me if you've heard this one before. Krark the Thumbless.
Oh, Krark. What did you do with Krark? I want to hear about
this. Yeah, so if people have been listening to the show enough, you know that I am a huge Boros stan. I love everything about red and white. I have a whole host of Boros decks. I love everything it can do because, again, I will say this, Boros is not just an equipment color. You can do pretty much anything you want in this color pairing as long as you use a little bit of ingenuity and some elbow grease. But what I did with this particular deck is a friend of the show, Scoop Phase, I know you're aware of him, he sent me a Krark that has a very interesting altar done to it. So he looks like he's masquerading a Halloween costume as Karn's Silver Golem. That's another story. But anyway, what Krark does in this deck is I've paired him with Prava of the Steel Legion, which was the Cat Soldier Uncommon partner out of Commander Legends, who's a 1/4 Cat Soldier for 2 and a white, reads, as long as it's your turn, creature tokens you control get +1/+4. And for 3 and a white, create a 1/1 white soldier creature token. And it's effectively a Boros tokens deck. I run a lot of tokens decks. And the goal is to just be able to get Krark out and then just copy some really zany spells and then hopefully be able to maybe a few things that can also copy spells and then just hopefully get enough tokens out there that are big enough that then I can just beat up my opponents with them. I have a couple of prowess creatures in there. I'm running Gutter Snipe. I'm running Thermal Alchemist, Young Pyromancer, Electrostatic Field, you know, all the spell slinger goodness stuff in there, but then running a lot of really fun red cards, including one of my favorite Magic the Gathering cards of all time, Empty the Warrens. You see where I'm going here.
I can see where you're going, and I am frightened.
Yeah, what's funny about this deck, though, is a couple of weeks ago, I was playing this in my local playgroup, and the first few times I played the deck, I basically lost every flip with Krark, and it was hilariously bad. So then I gave it to someone else in my playgroup, patron Nick S. on the show from the beginning here, actually. And he ended up playing the deck the next game and failed most of the flips, too. So, I mean, it was just fun that I think we got more fun out of the deck because of the coin flipping than anything that was going on in the field. And then we had another game where another member of our playgroup played the deck, didn't play Krark at all during the entire course of the game. And then Storm Count 8 with, First Day of Class on the field, which is hideously under underplayed in Kirk decks. So First Day of Class is a instant for one in a red out of Strixhaven, and reads, whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control this turn, put a +1/+1 counter on, and it gains haste until end of turn. And then you can learn, so you can basically loot. I'm sorry, rummage. And it's a great card. I threw it in there because I thought, okay, if I get a few tokens off something like Raise the Alarm, let's say, get 4 tokens out there off Kirk, well, all of a sudden now I have 4 2/2 soldiers, right? Well, this player figured out that if you don't mess around with Kirk and you can get your storm count high enough, empty the Warrens for storm count 8 plus First Day of Class, now you've got 16 2/2 goblins on the field. I regretfully say that I died to my own deck, and I died horribly to my own deck, and was just blown away by how crazy this deck could be even without playing Kirk. Is I kind of created some weird Boros Storm list, and I love this deck. It's fun to play. It always comes out of nowhere, and the coin flipping is just the best part of it, honestly.
It is, that sounds really sweet, and I don't know, dying to your own deck, doing something you never thought it could do, that's its own kind of amazing.
It really is, and I've learned so much about how to pilot this deck just from that single game. You can't afford to sleep on it, because it will kill you from out of nowhere if you're not ready for it.
All right, we got room for one more deck in our sliver, then?
Maybe two more if you have two, but probably, like, what would be your kind of pre-con level-ish deck that you would run if you wanted to make sure that you could hang at that level of play?
I think Oketra could do decent there, but I do actually keep together from the Innistrad Midnight Hunt set, I keep around the Wilhelt pre-con, actually, the blue-black zombies deck. That deck's got some chops. It does play at a similar power level with that nice late, like, turn 7, turn 8 critical turn. It has a nice long clock. Zombies are never going to be quick. And it is almost unmodified. I've made a few tweaks to it, throwing in some pet cards that I probably shouldn't be running, but just enjoy running a little bit too much, trying to get a little bit more value in the deck. But overall, it still kind of stays true to the heart and the speed of that Wilhelt deck. And that would probably be the one that I would make sure I take in to round out the different power levels of decks that I have. And guess what? It's a graveyard deck. I'm happy.
Sounds good. So on my end, again, since I run a lot of Battlecruiser decks, I feel like a lot could probably fit under this category. Part of me wants to say I could run Najeela at this point because it is so watered down that I could easily run this where, I mean, I can really only get like 1, maybe 2 extra combats per turn, maybe. But again, I don't really have a lot of ways to protect Najeela in that deck, so it's kind of a glass cannon in a way. So that's kind of in the running. Also, if I want to go further into the complete weirdness, I do either have my Jalira Master Polymorphous precon, the Card Kingdom precon, which is actually quite good and quite terrifying in its own ways. So if you're in the market for a precon, definitely check those Card Kingdom exclusives out. They're about $30 a piece, and I can definitely recommend that they are decent.
And I can recommend a Card Kingdom. Get this man a sponsorship.
Yes, that would be absolutely amazing. I could actually, you know, buy Mana Crypt. yeah.
That sounds like a really sweet set of decks to bring, though. It seems like at that point, we could sit down at just about any table at the next big Magic event, and whoever we get to sit down with, that would give us a chance to play with them.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. But yeah, since I do have some really bizarre decks, John, I'm curious to know, have you ever built a deck where you just thought, you know, this is the Chair Tribal deck? This is not intended to be good. It's intended to make a point. Have you ever built one of those decks? What kinds of decks
before? Yes. Yes, I did. And that was a deck built with, well, one partner who I really enjoy, Malcolm, and then Sakashima. And the deck was called Oops All Malcolm. So there's an interesting caveat to Malcolm. Malcolm only gets damage once per first strike damage per opponent, no matter how many pirates connect. So I built this deck to try to get as many pirates as I possibly could. None of them had first strike, but I wasn't going to tell my opponents that. Rather, I would read the text on the card and let them then infer, oh no, he's going to get like 21 treasures if he hits any of us with even just a handful of those. We have to do something. Even if I did manage to start connecting with multiple Malcolms on multiple opponents every turn, I would then reveal the top card of my library as another clone to make another Malcolm. Basically, unless you were worried about dying very slowly to a bunch of 2/2s with no pumps in there, you weren't in very much danger. I just wanted to cast a lot of clones, one of my favorite types of cards in the game, and what better to do it with the clone commander and my personal favorite pirate.
Definitely, definitely. On my end, if I was to be able to fit a seventh deck in here, again, since if I did take Jalira, which is unsleeved, I have been able to get seven decks in my quiver. If I wanted to just take the absolute chair tribal, like the Commander's Fear podcast lasagna tier, the most lasagna of the lasagna tier decks, that goes to my completely not commander legal, but I don't care version of Old Fogey. Yes, I have built an Old Fogey deck. So for those who don't know what Old Fogey is, he was a card out of... Which set was this? It wasn't Unstable. It was... let's check here. Unhinged. And Old Fogey is just a really funny card. It's a dinosaur for two for green. It's a 7/7 and has, get this, phasing, cumulative upkeep 1, echo, fading 3, bands with other dinosaurs, protection from homerids, snow-covered planeswalk, flanking, and rampage 2. And again, if you really start reading into the subtext behind this card, like what it does, it's actually really depressing, I suppose. But just on a player level, is this is the jankiest deck I have ever built, honestly. It's around a commander who basically, once you really boil it down to, you only get to have on the field every other turn. And what the deck is trying to do is effectively just mess around with those cumulative upkeep counters, because cumulative upkeep is actually an age counter. And again, John, you would know this having played an Ice Age, is that the cumulative upkeep is actually age counters. So these are counters that can be manipulated, right? Same with fading counters. So the whole deck is just filled with silly things like Ferripede, which is an unblockable 1/1 insect, and says whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you may remove a counter from target permanent. So basically it reads, you may remove a counter from target Old Fogey. Or another fun card in there is another, this is from the first unset, I think, and this was Hungry Hungry Heifer, 2 green, summon cow. And during your upkeep, remove a counter from any card you control or sacrifice Hungry Hungry Heifer. And all it says is moo for its flavor text. And it is the most bizarre deck, because I'm just literally trying to move counters on and off Old Fogey so I never have to sacrifice it, and then try to see if I can win the deck utilizing big, dumb creatures. Like, I've got Galta in there, Avenger of Zendikar, you know, some favorites in there, but just mostly just trying to get Old Fogey out there and just see what I can do with it. It is a hilarious deck. It has never won a game, but I can specifically say that running a weird mono-green proliferation with a technically not magic legal dinosaur guy with a whole bunch of silver border cards is probably about the most interesting experience you will ever see at an EDH table. I love this deck. I rarely ever play it because you need the exact right pod of people who don't really care about how bad your deck can get. But once you get into this sort of game, there's nothing like dropping a card called Everythingamajig onto the table, because people are just, what? It's great.
Oh, you got to bring it to a game with that I'm in. Hey, I thing in action.
Yeah, I love this deck. It is completely hilarious, completely terrible. And honestly, the whole point isn't even to win the game. I mean, it's nice if I can try to, but it's it's just a fun deck. I love it. And, you know, it's one of those reminders, I think, for everybody out there that, again, it's okay to build decks that are basically a theme or completely janky and weird, is that this is the fun of just brewing EDH. This is the fun of playing EDH. This is the kind of deck that I feel like really, really encapsulates, I guess, what Sheldon and his fellow judges were really getting into when they tried to build this format or first develop this format. It's like, this feels like as much spirit of the format, as far as I can think of it, as possible. It's that it's so crazy that, you know, you just have fun piloting it, even though it's a completely terrible deck.
At the end of the day, my philosophy is that there really is no terrible deck. The only terrible deck is one that comes to the table and the intent is wrong for the table. If you were to say, I want to bring that old fogey deck over to a CDH game, in that case, I'm saying, I'm sorry, man. You're the problem at that table. At the same time, if I come to the table where you're playing old fogey and somebody else is playing Phoebe Head of Sneak, and somebody else is on the green-white transmute mutate guy from Unstable as well. Well, if I bring my CDH deck to that table, I'm the problem there. It all comes down to that intent. Mm-hmm. And if everybody is on the same wavelength and they have the intent that they're looking for a similar experience, not always the same experience, but a similar enough experience, you're going to have a much better chance of finding it.
Definitely. And yeah, you're definitely right. The intent of this deck is just to do silly things and just have a silly commander who I need to have three or four dice out just to keep track of all the counters on, and have one or two abilities that might be halfway relevant once in a great while. But yeah, the fun of the deck is just piloting old fogey and just having this deck that just makes people wonder what the heck I was thinking, but also just have one of the best experiences that they've ever had playing in a game. I played this deck on Bobby Christine's stream a while back, and that was really fun. The game went really long, which I, you know, about 2 hour game with this deck isn't necessarily the best, but as far as just the fun level, you know, it's a great deck. I enjoy it. I am probably going to keep it together for a long time. It only comes out very occasionally because you have to have, again, the right pod with the right intent to ever play this. But if the conditions are right, I will bring Old Fogey to the table. No questions asked.
All right, you're inspiring me now. I've got to try to brew a silver border deck at some point too.
Yeah, so if people are interested in finding out more about this old fogey deck, I can leave the link in the description to this episode, and you can also check me out at moxfield.com under MTG and Quarantine. So if you're interested in looking at some of the decks that I've, or actually all of the decks that I've talked about today, they're all there.
All right, and most of my decks are actually under my personal account, but I will make sure by the time this episode goes live, I have them on Gemstone Mine podcast account on Moxfield as well.
Okay, sounds good. So I'll need that by tomorrow.
You got it, buddy.
All right, John. I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today about this stuff. We had a great conversation, and it sounds like you've got an interesting new brewing project to get to, so I'll leave you to that.
Hey, thanks for having me, MJ. It was a great time.
No problem. So again, if people would like to hear more about the Gemstone Mine podcast and YouTube content, where can they find you guys at?
Sure. So you can find us on YouTube, where we are Gemstone Mine Podcast, or you can add us on Twitter, where we're at Gemstone Mine MTG.
All right. Sounds good. And if you're interested in hearing more about my decks, you can find my podcast on the usual podcast outlets. That is Spotify, Google, Apple, Player FM, and the rest of them, Rocket Cast. I always forget all of them. There's just so many. But most of your typical podcast outlets, you can find me on those. You can also find me on Twitter at MTG in Quarantine. If you find the happy looking Ulamog wearing a pair of headphones, you found the right place. I'd also like to utilize this opportunity again to give a huge shout out and thank you to the awesome people who've supported me over at patreon.com/mtginquarantine. So another huge thank you to Mr. Big Benz, Anomaly, Draco Lucian, Neil Royal, Nick S., Infamous Fridge, and Frugal Brutal for supporting the show. If you would like to help support the show and help me make more awesome content, head on over to patreon.com/mtgandquarantine for more information. And this has been the MTG in Quarantine podcast. My name's MJ. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.